Did you know that only 6 months after the first shots of the Civil War, that a good number of the white people of Beaufort, South Carolina, either buried all of their valuables or loaded them onto wagons to escape the impending Yankee invasion? It was called the Great Skedaddle.
Welcome to the Lore of the South. Lore of the South.
Follow the show on social media to keep up with what's going on and to see pics that go along with each episode. Search for Lore of the South on TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook.
Welcome back to Lore of the South with me, Kelly Cruz. How the heck have y'all been? And Happy New Year. It's been a minute since we last talked, or it feels that way anyway, but the busiest time of the year is behind us and we're back to our regular schedules. We spent Christmas in Savannah with our youngest daughter and her best friend. Haley is graduating early, so we used this trip as her senior trip. She pretty much ran the show. We did a ghost tour, of course, and got to go into the Andrew Lowe house after hours, which was a treat. Andrew Lowe, just in case, just for some background info, was the father-in-law to Juliet Gordon Lowe, who was the founder of the Girl Scouts. And then we did a daytime tour of the Juliet Gordon Lowe house where she was born and where she held the very first Girl Scout meetings. Between the two tours, I got quite a few ideas for the podcast, so that was a bonus. Still haven't made it to the Grayface Museum or to do the paranormal investigation at the Sorrel Weed House. We'll have to do a whole podcast about the Sorrel Weed House sometime. Ghost hunters went there years ago and gave it their stamp of haunted, so it's definitely a place to check out. I've been there in the daytime, but have never done any of the night tours. So that's definitely on our list. And you know, we really probably should save some things to do in the future because we go to Savannah a couple times a year at least. And how about some history-making news? This story comes to us from Ancient Archaeology. The second largest Roman villa to ever be discovered in England was unearthed in Oxfordshire. The site was discovered by a metal detectorist named Keith Westcott. The villa is thought to be larger than that of the Taj Mahal, and dates from the year 99. Along with its elaborate mosaic floors, they found boar's tusks, Roman coins, and a sarcophagus containing the skeletal remains of a woman. The complex villa is thought to have once had a domed roof, heated bathhouse, and a grand dining room and kitchens. So, y'all might remember a while back, producer Mike and I ventured up to Beaufort, South Carolina for a weekend getaway. And we stayed in an Airbnb that used to be the office of the local sheriff, J.E. McTeer. He was quite a famous character from the area, as we were to come to find out. He was both the youngest and longest-term sheriff in the U.S. at the time. He was only 22 when he took up the reins of lawman from his father, who died while still in office in 1926. Back then, the office of sheriff was a part-time job, so when not performing his law enforcement duties, he sold real estate. Much of his job was busting up moonshine stills and intercepting rum runners along the coast. But he was also known as a conjure man, a witch doctor, a root worker amongst the Gullah Geechee population. So let's get into what a root worker is and who the Gullah Geechee are. So welcome to episode 57, Gullah Geechee Magic. The Gullah and the Geechee are by some considered two different groups of enslaved Africans. Their names were anglicized versions of African words like Gola and Kisi. Some linguists even think that the Gola is yet another anglicized word meaning Angola. a region of Africa that many of these people were stolen from. They are a people hailing from the western coast of Africa, and they were known for their knowledge of rice cultivation and the growing of cotton. So these enslaved were extremely valuable to the English, who were settling the Sea Islands that stretched from North Carolina down to nearly St. Augustine. Now, until our trip to Beaufort, I had thought that the Gullah Geechee was maybe a hyphenated name, that they were one people. But it came from the interpreter of the Gullah Geechee Welcome Center that the people were separated by the chains of islands that cluster up and down our Atlantic coast. The Gullah inhabit the more northern islands, while the Geechee are found primarily to the south in Florida and Georgia. Though I think any more, Gullah Geechee is just considered like a collective. Like, these people came from the same area of Africa. They were taken to these chains of islands. I digress. Let me get back to the story, y'all. They were linked by tradition, culture, skills, and that long, dark voyage across the ocean. The Gullah Geechee, being relegated to these remote island plantations, it really allowed for their own culture to flourish. But at the same time, I don't like using that word because they did have a boot on their necks. They were a property, one-fifth a human in the eyes of the U.S. government. But this remoteness allowed for their own language development along with the melting of Christian and old African religions. And with the mention of religion, it reminds me of an article I read how the islanders of St. Helena, Port Royal, and others along the coast, prayer circles directly mimic those from Africa. The prayers, worship songs, and clapping move in a counterclockwise fashion, just like in the traditional dances of West Africa. Maybe our island people along the Atlantic were able to hang on to those traditions easier than other enslaved who were sold further inland. Well, that's just a thought. Now, to talk a bit about root work and voodoo. Island people are a superstitious lot. No matter what continent your ancestors hailed from, island living leaves you to the elements. Those winds could blow in a plague of mosquitoes, which could turn into a plague of yellow fever or some other mosquito-borne disease. You deal with horrendous storms, floods, and flat-out unpredictable weather. To top it off, what if a neighbor didn't like the way you were handling your affairs and ill-wished you? And all of a sudden, all the children were sick and Granny couldn't be moved from the bed? Wouldn't you try anything to protect your family? Including paying the local conjurman to ward off the evil that might have been wished upon you? J.E. McTeer. The sheriff described bringing of the root work to the new world like so. They were Africans, and they were not really changed by South Carolina and its hot, humid islands. Quite the contrary, they brought the change to the land. The sheriff goes on to describe how root magic, or the dark arts as some call them, traveled all that distance through wars and many upheavals and still survived into the modern times. In his book, High Sheriff of the Low Country, the sheriff speaks of his many dealings with different root doctors over the years. The first of which was known as Doc Buzzard. He inherited his knowledge and title from his daddy and granddaddy before him. The root workers used a sort of subconscious manipulation to control their clients and victims. And Dr. Buzzard was a pro. He wore a uniform of the Conjure Man, a nice suit, a pair of highly polished shoes, and a set of sunglasses so reflective no one could see his eyes behind the lenses. He took in root work from all over the country in letter form. And he'd be seen down at the courthouse in the courtroom constantly chewing the root and staring endlessly at the prosecution. The root chewing was supposed to make any of the evidence against the defense into evidence for the defense. This was all well and good to the sheriff until they found root or brick powder dusted all along the desks and in the judges' chambers of the courthouse. That made the sheriff pay a call to old Doc Buzzard, whose reply was to placate the sheriff with two fat chickens for his dinner. But the root man was never again found applying his brick dust in the courthouse. The sheriff and his deputies followed many of the root work trade secrets in their own everyday working lives. One story goes that the jail housed a couple of young men on misdemeanors, and the pair were allowed out of their cells to help around the jail yard, minding the horses and other odd jobs. Well, it wasn't too long before the two became too comfortable in their situation and started taking field trips beyond the jail yard to go visit their mamas and their girlfriends. That's when one of the deputies came up with the idea to do a bit of his own root work. At lunchtime one day, the deputy calls the sheriff and the two inmates over to the open gate. The deputy pulls a leather tobacco pouch from around his neck. The sheriff standing to one side holding a pan of cornbread for the trustee's lunch. And the deputy then pinches some dust from the bag and sprinkles an X on the ground right in between the gate posts. He then told the two inmates that they were welcome to step over that X and leave any time, but their legs would never work again. And that, dear listeners, kept those two within the confines of the jail yard until their time was served. The sheriff tells even more tales of having to unconjure the conjured. In one case, a young mother was ritually attacked by a woman who was after her man. The mother came to the sheriff saying that she had made the mistake of having words with this other woman, and the next day she had walked barefoot across her porch and threw some sort of powder, and now she could barely stand because of the pain in her feet. So the sheriff told her he'd get back to her in a day or so and have an answer for her. He put together a few odds and ends into a drawstring pouch and gave it to the hexed woman. Well, it wasn't long until the jealous woman came to apologize to the young mother and then left town. Seemed that word had gotten out that the sheriff had put together some strong magic to counteract the weak little hex that the husband chaser had put together. The sheriff speaks of many of these root workers, including Dr. Bug, who at one time was Dr. Buzzard's main competition. Dr. Bug was illiterate and not up to date on the laws like Doc Buzzard was. But Bug was up on his herbal knowledge. It was during this time that the World War II draft was in full swing, and Beaufort County seemed to be having an epidemic of young black men with heart murmurs, because there had been a dozen or so turned down for military service because of these said murmurs. So it came down to the sheriff and the FBI to look into this. You know, it was a matter of national security. Well, come to find out, Dr. Bug was giving, for payment of course, the young draftees a heavy metal arsenic remedy to keep them out of service. So one of the side effects of arsenic poisoning is rapid heart rate or a heart murmur and other heart conditions, which will subside once the arsenic leaves the body. So the U.S. government didn't take a shine to this root work hustle and arrested Dr. Bug for practicing without a medical license and for attempted poisoning. What do y'all say? One more tale from the sheriff's book about the root work of Beaufort. This story was brought to the sheriff by one of his local wealthy farmers in the area. This time, a woman felt the death root had been placed on her by Dr. Buzzard. She'd been in bed for days, wouldn't eat or drink, just laid in her bed, eyes wide. So the sheriff agreed to accompany the farmer out to see the afflicted woman. The sheriff walks through the door of the little home and announces that there is indeed dark magic at work here, and he'd do everything in his power to help save the woman. So back to town he went. Once there, sheriff went to see another root doctor by the name of Dr. Hawk. The sheriff's line of thinking was to keep the doctors in the avian family, and like how rock beats scissors, hawk beats buzzard. Now for Dr. Hawk's day job, he ran a grocery store, and that's where the sheriff found him. He explained the situation to Dr. Hawk, and the root doctor agreed to help with the unhexing. He created what he called a red root, and the pair drove it out to the woman's house after dark when they were sure not to be discovered. Dr. Hawk then buried the red root at the base of the sick woman's porch steps, making sure to smooth the dirt over to hide where the digging had taken place. The next morning, the pair drove back out to the woman's house. Neighbors, friends, and family had all gathered to watch the root work be done. Heck, the sick woman herself had been brought out on the porch, bed and all, so she could also witness the magic that was about to be unleashed. Doc Hawk went and broke a springy twig from a peach tree and used it like a dowsing rod. He swished around the yard until he came to the porch steps. He knelt and began to dig. He drew out the jar full of a red substance, and the crowd in the yard gasped and receded. The sick woman sat straight up in bed and turned towards the root doctor. Dr. Hawk then yelled, "Stand back, all of you! This is a death root!" The folks didn't have to be told twice, and they fled the area. Dr. Hawk jogged a little ways down to the river and flung the concoction into its depths. He returned to the woman's bedside and told her, "Daughter, I have taken this powerful root off of you. I have killed it. Now rise up and be well again." And apparently she did just that. Side notes, and I got a few of them, y'all. Where to start? Okay, so the sheriff went on to serve in the Coast Guard in World War II, then went back to office when the war was over. In all, he was sheriff from 1926 to 1963, nearly 40 years of service. He passed away in 1979 at the age of 76. And just before his passing, he lived to see the bridge over the Beaufort River named after him. Y'all give his biography a read if you care to. It's a short little book, but it's pretty interesting. He got up to all kinds of shenanigans in the swamps and waterways in Beaufort. And again, the name of the book is High Sheriff of the Low Country. And I got my copy on Amazon, so it's still available. And here's our Side Notes Part 2. I think this is the first Side Notes Part 2. The Gullah Geechee and Beaufort herself. When in that area, make sure to go out to St. Helena's and visit the Gullah Geechee Visitor Center. They are a wealth of knowledge and also have some beautiful artwork and examples of the seagrass baskets that the people make. These baskets are woven so tightly in some cases that they are near waterproof. Also located on St. Helena is the home of the Penn School. But y'all, that's going to be a whole episode of its own. Beaufort is definitely part of the South, but its relationship within it is very different from many of the places I've traveled. Oh, and just another little, here's a side note, part three. Talking about the root work and stuff, producer Mike and I did spot like a little piece of root work. We did a ghost tour. And in Beaufort, it is full of churches and cemeteries. And many of the cemeteries are on church grounds. So I guess that makes it a graveyard, right? If it's part of a church, it's a graveyard. If it's standalone, it's a cemetery. Yeah, that's how it goes. So these graveyards aren't locked up at night like they are here in Florida. When the sun goes down, they lock the gates on cemeteries and graveyards. But these are open. So in this tour, we were taken through one of the church graveyards, and upon exiting it, there had been an X drawn on the pavement in front of the opening, the gate, where a gate would be in the opening there. So I guess they were trying to keep a boo hag inside that cemetery and not let it out, because there were X's at the entrance and exit. So I thought that was pretty neat and something to share with y'all. But now we're going to move on to our oldest buildings in the U.S. brought to us by the Discoverer blog. And today we've got the Henry Whitfield House in Connecticut. It was built in 1639 near the town of Gulford. The house actually predates the town. It's the oldest stone building in New England. And our next house is the Block House in Nomans Creek, Delaware. I'm sure I'm not saying that right, y'all. Built by the settling Swedish in 1654. It would have been prized as a defensive structure, and only a year later it was captured by the Dutch. It was attacked by Native Americans in 1671 and then fell into British hands in 1777. You could still visit the blockhouse today in Claymont, Delaware. Well, I hope y'all enjoyed this episode. We're back in full swing from the holidays, and I think might be needless to say that there will definitely be more episodes about Beaufort coming y'all's way. Shoot, just a great skedaddle be a good episode. Oh, and not to mention the Penn School. If y'all want to cheat, Google it. It's a super interesting piece of history. Really fascinating. And you can still visit the Penn School today. It's still there, and they have reenactments and all kinds of stuff. And seems like I needed to tell y'all something else and I didn't put it in my script. Oh well, I don't remember. Make sure y'all follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. I always post pictures to go along with each episode on Instagram and Facebook, so be sure to follow us there. I have a lot of pictures from when we went to Beaufort that I'll share with y'all. Look for us on Patreon. We have our very first two supporters, Judy and Sydney. Thank y'all so much. And if y'all want a little extra content, that's the place to find it. And you can get it for as little as $3 a month. And you're really helping with the show. It pays for, well, like the book that I mentioned here today. The High Sheriff of the Low Country. I mean, it helps pay for like literature, study materials, equipment, like the laptop had to go into the shop a while back. I mean, you know, that kind of stuff, it adds up. But anyways, but if you can't swing the Patreon, please leave us a 5-star written review where you can. I know you can on Apple Podcasts and you can on Spotify, so that would be a great help, y'all. And if you do leave a review, I will be sure to read it out here on the podcast, good or bad. We had one, Captain Meanie, and I read his out too. I mean, I assume it was a dude. I don't know if it was or not. Anyways, well, Happy New Year's, y'all. And we'll talk to y'all later on War of the South.
Stay tuned for a preview of our latest Patreon episode.
I digress.
Oh, if it came down to just being lazy and hanging out in bed and just having somebody bring us food all the time, I think.
Could you lay on your side and like eat a pizza?
We did this weekend with a hamburger.
We didn't lay down. We were sitting.
I guess that's true.
We weren't like reclined. It was like dropping French fries down our gullets.
By the way, we had ordered room service.
For the first time ever, and we're in our 40s.
At almost midnight.
Yeah.
After having some not so good pizza at the park. Ugh. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah. Back to Saturnalia. So one of the things they would do to choose the Lord of Misrule would be bake coins into like cakes and different dishes, which may sound a lot like king cakes at Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
The practice spread through Europe and the British Isles as the Romans claimed more and more territory. And the practice of Saturnalia evolved or was absorbed into Christianity and as it gained in popularity. And it's thanks to this ancient Roman holiday that Jesus got his birth date of December 25th. Because according to the Roman calendar, the solstice fell on December 25th.
Oh, okay.
So the sun is reborn. The sun is born.
Right.
Hence Jesus' birth date.
If you loved what you heard, check out the Patreon page for exclusive content by searching for The Lore of the South on patreon.com.